Welcome to the Catholic Sphere. Each week we have a different host and a different focus as we tackle topics important to Catholics around the globe. I'm your host this week, Debbie Cowden, and in today's episode, we'll be discussing heroic motherhood and how moms can find holy in the hard seasons of life. My panelists today are Michaela Harrison, illustrator at the Liturgy of the Home, joining from Oklahoma, Julia Marie DiGiorgio Woolbright of the Musings of a Catholic Mama blog from North Carolina, and Lisa Canning, author of The Possibility Mom and a Catholic Women's Business Coach from Toronto, Canada. I am so thankful these beautiful women have joined me today to share their stories. It really takes a lot of courage and vulnerability to bear your heart. And my hope is that others who are listening today can be encouraged to persevere during their trials as well. So Michaela, I would love to start with you. Now, when you and I were first talking about you coming onto the Catholic sphere, you had candidly told me that you were still in what you called the bruised and battered season of life. So let's take a step back, if you don't mind, and first talk about what was happening in your life when you found out that your two-year-old son had a brain tumor.
Well, we were living a beautiful rural life out in the country. We had a little farm, we had dairy goats, we lived near Clear Creek Abbey, and I was not only juggling the sort of the country life, but then I was also had found myself in this work of making these illustrated liturgical calendars for families, and was just in the midst of juggling everything. It already felt like too much, and I was like, Lord, you know, I need help right now. And then, you know, we started seeing that my youngest, Jamie, he was, you know, a year and a half when he started having some symptoms. And I just remember thinking something's not right. And we're taking him to doctor after doctor. And it wasn't until, I guess, it was January of 24 when we finally got to the neurologist. And he said, you know, you got to take him straight to the ER. This sounds like a brain tumor. And little did I know that life was going to be totally different and flipped upside down. But that's part of the story.
Mm-hmm. And as a mom myself, I recognize that the day-to-day parts of motherhood, like you said, and being a full-time working mom and a business owner are difficult enough. And then facing something like this can really quickly destroy that work-life balance and that beautiful quintessential farm life that you had talked about. And that balance is already so delicate anyways. Lisa, first of all, welcome back to the Catholic Sphere. Our viewers recognize you as the Possibility Mom, who helps other moms, me included, build up the skill sets to manage the day-to-day duties of being moms, working moms, business owner moms. That doesn't mean that everything in your life has been 100% smooth sailing. So let's talk about some of the difficult seasons of life that you've been through.
In 2023, I lived in 10 homes in 10 months while being pregnant with baby number 10 on this side of heaven. It was quite the adventure, and we found ourselves in a constant state of upheaval. The short story of it is that nobody would rent to our family, and we found ourselves in short-term housing after short-term housing. Part of that story also was one of my children developed an allergic reaction at one of the homes, which made it very tricky. She was in hospital for over a week, and then we had to very quickly find ourselves a more appropriate place to be able to support her health. Throughout the experience, it was a lot of questioning the Lord. Why? Like, why would you allow this to happen? Why would you allow these circumstances and allow so many people to say, no, you can't, you know, stay in our home? And it took a long time to get to that point of asking, okay, Lord, now what? You've allowed this type of suffering. You've allowed this time of upheaval. But what is it that you want me to do? And what is it that you want me to learn?
And now, Julia Marie, you are a working mom too. Our Instagram audience might recognize you because of the story that you've shared about your daughter, Anastasia, who had anencephaly. So tell us about her diagnosis and what was going through your heart and mind in the days and weeks following that diagnosis.
Yeah, Anastasia was our fourth baby. We have three boys, so we were very excited and very nervous to have a daughter after you know, all the boy mom life. And I was, her pregnancy was difficult. I was so sick. It was just something, I chalked it up to her being a girl. And finally we had routine blood work done. And I remember it was like 1 o'clock in the morning on a Thursday night. And I got an email back with the results that said that she had tested positive for spina bifida. So my husband was out of town for work. I'm trying not to panic. The midwife calls me the next day and says, "Hey, I'm so sorry that you got that email. But we are going to send you for a level 2 ultrasound at the hospital an hour away." And so we went through that whole weekend just kind of thinking, you know, this is, it's going to be what it is. We love her no matter what. My husband was so sweet. He was like, you know, if she's in a wheelchair, it'll be fine. She's going to have fantastic arms. She'll be a tennis pro. Like, we really went into that ultrasound very willing to accept whatever answers they gave us. And when we went into the room, you know, they showed us, her spine looked beautiful. She looked so perfect. And the tech was like, "Okay, is there anything else you want to see?" And I asked, "Well, where's her little profile? I want to see her face." And that's when she turned to us and said, "Okay, there is something wrong. You've probably not heard of this, but I believe your daughter has anencephaly. Her neural tube did not close all the way. So she does not have, from about her eyebrows up, like her skull is just not there." And at that moment, just my whole world came crashing down. It was one, I can think of the two worst moments of our whole experience. That was one of them. And then later on, it was after she passed away and having to give her over to the coroner. But it just, it, you can't be prepared for news like that. It just knocks the wind out of you. And it, in that moment, it was just this very clear, like, all right, this is our life now. This is our journey. What are we going to do?
And as parents, we want to be the ones to provide stability and the feeling of safety for our kids. Michaela, but sometimes catastrophic things like this happen that are beyond our control, and we're essentially helpless. And you experienced that when Jamie was in the ICU after his diagnosis. So tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I knew that something was wrong. And then once we were told, you know, by the neurologist to go to the ER to go figure out what was wrong. And they did the CT scan, and they came in and said, "Yeah, your son has a brain tumor that is basically the size of a small apple right in the middle of his brain." And I was like, on the one hand, I was like, well, that's what it was. And the other hand, I was like, oh my goodness, this is the worst case scenario. And everyone kept saying, "Oh, don't think worst case scenario." And it was like, no, this is worst case scenario. And so I don't know. It just was really, I tried to be there for him. You know, I was like, I'm going to be strong. I'm going to keep him happy. You know, he's, you know, a little almost two-year-old, he just turned two. He's all, you know, got all these hooked up to all these tubes, and he wants to play and he wants to move around. And it's like, trying to keep him happy. And like, on the one hand, you're so afraid, like, my child could die. And on the other hand, it's like, he just wants the toy, or he just wants whatever it is at the time. And so just that juggling was just, you know, was really hard. And then after he went into the surgeries and he was on all the drugs, and it's like, you want to be there and hold him and make it better. And you have to just let them come and put the needle in or take, you know, whatever it was. And he didn't want it. And he'd be like, "Mom," like looking at me like, "Mom, don't let them do this to me." And he couldn't talk, but I knew what he was saying. And I was like, you just have to go through it. Like, I love you and I'll be there for you, but just having to watch him go through that. And that's really hard for a mom, but you have to, you know, it's just a process of letting go. And it wasn't like I was doing a very good job of letting go. It's just trying to live and survive. And you learn just by going through it.
Lisa, when you were pregnant with your 10th child, Judy, you found out that you had miscarried her at 9 weeks. What was that experience like of learning that you had miscarried, and how did you navigate that loss?
Miscarriage is an interesting thing because there really isn't very much one can do, I would say, most of the time to prevent it. It's sometimes, you know, I was very healthy. I had had 9 healthy pregnancies to that point. And so this was a very big shock and a big surprise. And it again had me asking this question of why, Lord, would you allow this to happen? I think when you go through times of trial, you can, I don't know, the brain can do kind of funny things where you're just like, did I do something to make this happen? Are you punishing me, Lord? And I think a really important thing to remember is the nature of God, that God is good. And when we can remember that God is good, and this is what I had to, it didn't happen quickly. Like, this took a very long time, but to be reminded that God is good and that he allows suffering for our benefit. I think that is one of the biggest gifts of our Catholic faith. You view suffering not as something that like is a punishment or, you know, God is mad at us, but that there can be redemption. There can be something that we are supposed to learn either about ourselves or about our Lord. And then also that there might be something, and this is still really, really hard for me to accept, but I've been growing in this acceptance over the years, especially recently, is that it might be a gift for someone else. I mentioned earlier that we lived in 10 homes in 10 months. And I remember one of my biggest fears was that my children would see the experience as hardship and just remember turmoil and remember trial. But what's so interesting on the other side, you know, now I'm more than a year out from probably the most adventurous year of our lives. My daughter just presented a speech at school on how it invited her to be on an adventure, how it invited her to trust the Lord, and how that you can find surprises in situations that look bleak, but that are actually for your benefit, for you to grow in virtue, for you to grow in perseverance. And so while it can be so difficult and you're like, Lord, why would you allow this to happen? When you can see that it can be a gift for someone else, that can put suffering in such a different context.
Julia Marie, with Anastasia's diagnosis of anencephaly, there's no cure. And so there's not much at all that you could really do for your daughter except carry on with the pregnancy for as long as possible. So what was that like?
It was hard. It's very, those first few hours after the diagnosis, it was, I mean, I've always been very pro-life. So it was very clear to us, you know, to my husband and I, that like we were going to carry on. We weren't going to, because it was offered to us, or the option to terminate or to even just induce early. I was only 19 weeks. She was going to be so small. There was no other option for us, just with our values, our faith, but the way forward was so unclear. It was so heavy, and you feel so helpless as a parent. You know, you, especially like through pregnancy, you're not drinking, you're not eating things you're not supposed to. You're doing everything you can to keep this baby healthy, and then to be told that your baby is incompatible with life, it just rocks you to your core. And throughout the pregnancy, there was just this sense of, all I can do is pray. All I can do is wake up every day and feel her and listen to her heartbeat and just know that she is not feeling any pain. That is one of the biggest graces that we had for our girl, was that she didn't even have the part of her brain that would let her feel pain. So as people, we did have a couple of people tell us flat out, like, why are you doing this? You should just abort her. Don't put yourself through this. Don't put her through this. And my response was always, she's fine. She is happy. She is safe. And, you know, as a mom, you want to do everything you can for your baby. And the only thing I could do for her was give her that comfort and just let her know every day I loved her and I was going to keep her as safe for as long as I could.
Michaela, as a mother, of course our children are inseparable from our lives, and what happens to one family member really has a profound impact on all of the others. It's like a ripple effect. So while Jamie was receiving that treatment, what was it like for your other children at home?
It was really hard for them. When I said, you know, goodbye to them in the morning when we were going to the neurologist, I thought I'd see them that evening, and then I didn't see them for 6 weeks because everything just went kicked into high gear with being in the ICU, and they got sick back at home. Thankfully, I did have family, so my mom came and stayed with my children. But 6 weeks is a long time. We're a very close-knit family. I don't think my kids had ever been away from me for any length of time. And it was really hard for my girls. I have, you know, two boys that are now 13 and 11, so they would have been, you know, a little younger, but, and then two girls. And the girls are very much like, just, mom, what's going on? You know, we want to be with you. And so I remember it being really hard to talk to them on the phone or on Skype, try to stay connected with them, try to help coach them through this. You know, your brother has a brain tumor. I have to stay with him. You know, I love you. I tell them, you know, I pray with them. There were some times where they couldn't go to sleep at night. They'd be calling me, you know, in the middle of the night, mom, I can't sleep. Why aren't you home? Especially for my, she was five at the time. I think she had the hardest time in some ways. But it's just, you're telling them the words that are true. They're hard, but they're true. And you're also telling yourself at the same time, you know, God is in control of this. You know, we don't know a lot, but we know that we love Jamie. We're going to do everything we can for Jamie. And we're also going to make sure that you're cared for at the same time. And so, you know, it's hard to help try to be stable for your children when you're not always feeling stable. But words are really important and prayer is really important. And I'm just so grateful for the faith because it really keeps you grounded. And, you know, when we were in the ICU for those 5 weeks, there was a lot of people there that didn't necessarily have faith, that didn't have that grounding. And it's really hard to see. I almost feel like on the one hand, like, yes, my child was suffering. Yes, that was really hard. But my husband and I had each other, and we really, you know, clung on to each other during that time. But, you know, there's a lot of single people out there, single parents, or even children that were there without their parents. And so the brokenness, and I just, you know, every time that a chaplain would come in, I'd be like, what do you tell the families? Like, how do you help them if they don't have faith? And he's like, it's really hard if you don't have faith. And so it just, above all, like that gratitude that God is with us and just, and so we would offer up our sufferings for those other families as well. And it's a beautiful thing when you can suffer together and really go. The only place you can go is like you either have the choice to despair and feel resentful, or you just cling on to hope and you trust in God even when it's hard to do so.
And Lisa, when you're experiencing grief, people often say it comes in waves. And after your baby Judy's death, you had mentioned that it felt like a tsunami. So what did you learn from the storms of grief that you had experienced both immediately after her death and then in the months following?
Much like a wave or a tsunami, a little bit more of extreme of an example. Or I also, it comes to mind the visual of a contraction, like when you're in labor. You have to go through it. Like the wave is going to come, that contraction is going to happen, and you're going to hit this point of, I cannot do this anymore. But then the wave subsides, the contraction reduces. And you very often, you know, to use birth again as an example, you very often have a moment of like, okay, I'm going to catch my breath. I think life is no different. The suffering in life, I hate to say it, and I wish, honestly, I truly wish it wasn't true, to be honest. One can organize their life and like get all the help and all the work and, you know, hire out this and, you know, make life easy, make some of the practical things easy. You can do that. You can have the best spiritual director. You can, you know what I mean? Like you can have the best resources, but suffering is going to happen. It is just inevitable on this side of the veil, we are going to suffer. It is just a reality of life. And so I think the faster we can come to accept that, that just like contractions during birth, just like a wave that's going to hit and then is going to recede, it's going to happen, but it will also dissipate. And this is where being a person of hope, this is where that line in that song, that through my suffering, I can find a way to praise. This is where being people of hope is so important. And it's when we move from the why, okay, why, Lord, why are you doing this? Why all this suffering? Why is life so hard? Why did you take my baby? Why could I not hold her? And then you go to what? Okay, Lord, you've allowed this to happen. Now what? What am I meant to learn? What am I meant to learn? How am I to cling on you? And how can this maybe be a gift for someone else? And I just want to touch on those two things. I think in times of trial, there's this unique sort of experience where you can try to rely on yourself. And you can do some of those things. Like I said, you can have a nice bath. You can drink a lot of water. You can make sure you're getting outside. Those kinds of things that are, you know, certainly like self-directed, right? But at some point, you must learn how to rely on the Lord. And that can look like a lot of things. That can look like prayer is your lifeline. That can look like sitting in adoration as a way to calm down rather than scroll aimlessly on your phone. It can look like a rosary instead of impulse eating for that comfort. And that is just such a huge lesson to learn that I think for a lot of people, it takes too long. And sometimes for some people, this is where suffering can be a gift. Because it's a quote unquote forced invitation, if you will, to meet the Lord where you clearly have no control and say, I trust you, even when I fear that trusting you is going to be more difficult. And then this gift to others, when you're on the other side of suffering. So I'm now about a year or so, you know, I'm 2 years out from a miscarriage. I'm about a year from living in 10 homes in 10 months. And being able to look back and see now with wisdom, ah, Lord, you allowed me to go through that so I could really gain a sense of what it's like to fully rely on you instead of myself. I'm like an expert at relying on myself, but you've given me now experience to rely on you. You've given me evidence, Lord, of how you do provide, how you can provide. I think of all the people who helped me during my miscarriage and during our unique year of moving so many times. I think of how much I prayed and how much I just gave my sorrow, gave my suffering and just literally sat at the foot of the cross and cried and wept. I think of just the compassion that I experienced and the generosity from others. I had to learn to let other people help me in these seasons. And these are all things that help us to grow in virtue, grow in humility. And again, remember that this life is temporary, and truly what we're being equipped for is this life eternal.
Julia Marie, you had set your induction date for March 25th, which is the Solemnity of the Annunciation of the Lord. So please tell us, why did you pick that date? And then in the weeks leading up to Anastasia's birth, what were the requests that you had made of God?
So with babies with anencephaly, it's important that they're born when they're still kind of small. So my midwife had said, you know, we probably should look at inducing you around, you know, anywhere from 36 to 38 weeks, just to avoid her getting stuck on the way out. So, which was a very big blow for me, because, I mean, again, the only thing I could do to help her was keep her safe, was keep her in me and make sure that, because as long as she was in my womb, she was happy, she was healthy, she was safe. So looking ahead at those dates, I pulled up the calendar and she was like, hey, look at some time, or let's go ahead and look at the 37 week mark and just kind of see what that gives us. And I remember pulling up the calendar and seeing that the window that my midwife had given me, I had two choices. I had the the Feast of St. Joseph, and then I had the Solemnity of the Annunciation. And I just felt this peace come over me, because it felt like God saying, like, hey, it's okay. You can let her go. It's not going, you're not hurting her. And so I was like, I've always had a personal devotion to the Annunciation. It was kind of one of those moments of like, huh, I wonder if maybe God was preparing my heart, you know, all these years. Like, I never understood why the Annunciation spoke to me so deeply. And it's like, oh, well, this would explain it. You know, this is my moment to emulate Our Lady's fiat. This is my chance to say yes to God, yes to bringing this sweet little life into the world. And leading up to her birth, I mean, you know, she was, as they said, incompatible with life. So, you know, knowing I didn't pray for a miracle, like I didn't pray for complete healing. People would say that all the time. Oh, we're praying for her to just come out and have her head and just be fine. And I'm like, yes, that would be great, but I'm going to just, I just wanted three things. I'm like, God, I don't need this gigantic miracle. If you wanted to, fantastic. But all I want is just for her to be born alive. It was the first and my deepest prayer, was just let her be born alive. Let me be able to look at her face to face while her heart is beating. My second prayer was for her to receive her sacraments. And finally, I wanted her to meet her brothers. You know, we were very forthright with our boys going through the whole process. And they were so excited to have a baby sister. So I just wanted them to be able to meet her before she passed away. And, you know, God delivered all of that and more.
And I can't wait to share with our viewers, and have you share with them how he answered those prayers in such a big and beautiful way. Now, viewers, we've run out of time today, but don't worry, we are going to be continuing these stories in an upcoming episode. So Michaela Harrison, Julia Marie Woolbright, and Lisa Canning, thank you so much, ladies, for joining me. And I want you to know again, we're gonna continue these beautiful stories in a future episode coming very soon. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again right here on The Catholic Sphere.